Welcome to the Back 9 Report, presented by eDraft.com.
Welcome to this week's very special edition of the Back 9 Report, presented by eDraft.com. We go live every Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, checking on the world of golf to bring you the latest news, insights, analysis, interviews, recaps, previews. Hey, we cover anything and everything golf. My name is Carlos Torres. Every week I'm alongside my co-host Fred Alveda, but this week is very special. Like I mentioned, this is our usual top stories of the year, and it's going to be for the top stories of the 2015 year. And we're bringing in reinforcements. Going to bring them in one by one. And let's start by one of the friends of the show, sports and golf writer, Mike May. Hi, how are you today?
It's a pleasure. This is an exciting show to be a part of. It's been a great year in golf, and I'm going to be looking forward to giving a few thoughts and observations as we move forward over the next 90 minutes. It'll be fun.
And we look forward to that. And another one of our reinforcements, you know this one a lot, and is our European guru, Kieran Clark. Hi, welcome again to the show. How are you, Kieran?
Well, thank you, Carlos, and I'm feeling very well. And like Mike, looking forward to talking about the 2015 in golf, you know, a momentous year for the game and the women's game and the men's game, of course, with some really fantastic major championships and some really exciting stories. And I must also quickly say that, you know, we are providing tonight a real public service to the American people, because they can either listen to us or listen to Donald Trump and Jeb Bush and Ben Carson. So I think, you know, we are here doing it for the people. So thank you very much.
We are the alternative, as usual. So
we are the same alternative to the insanity on that Republican side.
Excellent. I couldn't have said it better. Hey, Fred. Hi. How are you today?
I am excited, Carlos, to have Kieran and Mike join us to do our year-end extravaganza, counting down the top 12 stories from 2015. But Kieran, never fail. We are going to talk about Dirt Donald tonight.
Oh yeah, no.
He's going to win the next one. Don't give it away. Everybody wants to know which were the best stories for the year of 2015. So you want to find out, you better stay tuned in. So we're going to start I'm sorry about that. I'm having some...
My God, Carlos, that's so cheesy.
Sorry. So, let's just...
Hi, this is Casey Kasem in Hollywood. Casey, count them
down. Oh, my
we
God.
We pull out all the stops here on back
today. What is going on? I'm sorry about that. But like Casey Kasem would say, on with the countdown. And let's start with number 12. And... you know, last year, Dr. Charles Clifford was in our countdown of the top stories. Unfortunately, this year, he makes number 12 for a different reason. Number 12 is the deaths of Billy Casper and Dr. Charles Clifford. And Mike will take the tee shot, the first one today. So, Mike, how about this unfortunate incident this year?
Well, we lost two champions of golf this year. Actually, both gentlemen died within 4 days of one another. Charlie Schiffer died February 3rd, Billy Casper February 7th. When you look at their resumes, it's nothing short of spectacular, and it's no surprise why both gentlemen are members of the World Golf Hall of Fame. If I could look at what Billy Casper has done, if he had played golf in any other country in the world, he would probably be declared that one of that country's not only greatest golfers but greatest athletes. Ryder Cup captain in 1979. Won the 1966 U.S. Open in a great comeback over Arnold Palmer. Won the 1970 Masters. Two-time money winner on the PGA Tour. Five-time Varden Trophy winner, which goes to the player with the lowest stroke average. That is the epitome of good play. Inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame in 1978. Seventh in tour all-time with 51 wins. He was sort of that quiet soldier who just was productive every year and was sort of lost and forgotten in the shadow of Nicholas and Palmer and Player and Trevino to an extent. And then he was successful in the what was then the Senior PGA Tour. Charlie Sheppard, I actually saw him play in person at the 1987 PGA Seniors event in Atlanta, Georgia. It was a Horseshoe Bend, and it was the Pepsi Senior Challenge, and he walked alongside one day along Gary Player and had that cigar in his mouth the whole time, and how anyone can play as well as he did with the cigar in your mouth at the same time is nothing short of spectacular. He was a humble man, quiet, soft-spoken. He went on tour. He unfortunately didn't qualify for the Masters. There were rules at the time that didn't allow him to play. But if it wasn't for Charlie Sifford, we wouldn't have had Lee Elder. We wouldn't have had Jim Dent. We wouldn't have had Charlie Owens. We wouldn't have had Calvin Peet. Trevino calls Charlie Sifford the Jackie Robinson of golf, and that says it all. Jackie Robinson is a big player in baseball, still is a leading figure, and Charlie Sifford may be gone but never forgotten. And if you ask Tiger Woods, he gives a lot of credit to the trailblazing activities of Charlie Sifford. Again, he was a quiet man who let his golf team do all the talking, and he was a great player. He actually won the 1975 PGA Seniors Championship. So, again, inducted to the Hall of Fame in 2004 and a very worthy inductee. I don't want to take too much time. I'll pass it on to Kieran for your thoughts on Billy and Charlie.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. And I have to concur with everything you said there about both Billy Casper and Charles Sifford. And you're two incredible players and two incredible personalities in the game. And Billy Casper really is the epitome of someone who perhaps was lost out in the marketing battle in the 1960s. You know, he had a relationship with Mark McCormack, who of course was a great agent of that time in sports, and particularly golf. And they had a falling out. And as a result of that, Casper was largely cut out and pushed aside in the creation of the Big Three, which Mark McCormack was the person who created that, of course, Arnold Palmer, Jack Nicklaus, and Gary Player. So Casper was right up there with them throughout that decade, winning so many PGA Tour events, winning major championships, being, as Mike said, a fantastic player on the tour, twice money list winner and so on. And he was a kind of an unsung hero, a largely overlooked player. And, of course, Billy Casper did release a book a number of years ago, which he entitled The Big Three and Me. And I think if you ask any of Gary Player, Jack Nicklaus, and certainly Arnold Palmer, they will all say that at that time they themselves felt like it was a big four, and Billy Casper played a massive role in that period in the game, and will certainly go down as being one of the greatest players of his generation. And Charlie Sifford, of course, was a remarkable guy, a brave guy, had to fight through all kinds of boundaries to get onto the game that he loved, the game he wanted to compete in and make a living from. And he fought through a lot of real tough times during that period in America. And as Mike rightly said, all the players who followed him from that period, African-Americans, they are indebted to Charlie Sifford. He fought for that cause, and he got onto the tour and had a successful career later on in his life, of course, and had a long life, and he lived to his 92, received the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2007, which was obviously richly deserved. And Tiger Woods referred to him as being almost like a grandfather figure for him. Two great men, two great players, and two guys who had a huge legacy in the game. And Fred, I'm sure you'll agree with that as well.
Absolutely. Billy Casper never got the recognition he richly deserved because he wouldn't join Mark McCormack's traveling circus with Nicklaus, Palmer, and Player. But he may have gotten the last laugh. Billy Casper Golf operates 150 golf courses in 29 states and is one of the largest media public relations firms in the U.S. His brand includes the Buffalo Brand Invigoration Group, which manages public relations, strategy development, integrated markets, and for companies that are in the golf market. Buffalo Turf and Landscape provides golf course agronomic programs with a new fee for service structure. And then there's also Women on Course, which is the nation's premier golf networking organization. So Billy Casper evolved and grew a business in addition to being a great golfer, and his legacy lives on. And, guys, I just want to note for the record that Charlie Sifford owned a golf course and resided in Ohio for many years. Ohio, as you all know, is the center of the golf universe. He is only the third golfer behind Palmer and Nicklaus to be awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom also, guys.
I don't know how many times he's going to mention that on the show. I don't know.
Go back.
You know, next year I'm gonna make it a personal task to mention how many times you're gonna say that, you know, Ohio is the center of the.
It'll be we'll put out an over under.
Yeah, let's do that.
Carlos, can I make a suggestion?
Yes.
About Fred. I think we should ask Donald Trump to declare a ban on Fred ever mentioning Ohio on this show.
That would be a good question for
I think we'd all support that.
I think it's worth noting that maybe the greatest Buckeye golfer of all time is probably Jack Nicklaus, true?
Oh, yeah, they just had a Golf Week just did a thing on that. I was a close second, but Jack Hanley was.
But it's worth noting, Fred, that the greatest Buckeye of all time has been living full-time in the state of Florida since the early 60s.
Ooh.
Well, I understand, but he's still got a house in Columbus.
Oh, yeah.
He lives down here, he pays his taxes down here, he visits Ohio.
That's because you guys don't have any state tax.
He's a smart
guy. We got to move on. Let's go, Carlos.
Let's go on. Number 11. This year, we saw a new European Tour CEO, and that's Keith Paley. He took over the European Tour with a lot of things to do, a lot of challenges. And Kieran is going to talk to us about what Keith Paley has done and what he expects to be done.
Well, thank you, Carlos. And yes, Keith Pelly, the 51-year-old Canadian, also became the new CEO of the European Tour, replacing George O'Grady back in the summer. And Pelly brought a wealth of great experience to the role. You know, he was previously the president of Rogers Media, which is a media conglomerate in Canada, which includes 51 radio stations, 56 written publications, 12 national TV stations, plus 42 local stations, 300 digital properties, as well as the Toronto Blue Jays, who are Canada's only Major League Baseball team. And during that tenure at Rogers Media, Pelly helped orchestrate the largest sports rights deal in Canadian history, the first kind of its kind worldwide, with the acquisition of a $5.2 billion National Hockey League rights deal for 12 years to include all media platforms. And Pelly was earlier Executive Vice President of Strategic Planning at CTV Globe Media and President of Canada's Olympic Broadcast Media Consortium, where he had Rogers and CTV's unprecedented coverage of the Vancouver 2010 Winter Olympic Games. He led that coverage. And bringing that great experience and knowledge of 30 years in the sports and media industry, Pelly was a fresh choice to lead the European Tour, which has long been in need of rejuvenation, with purses over in the PGA Tour overwhelming those on this side of the pond to such an extent that the vast majority of the leading players from Europe have sought to play full-time in the United States. And now, in less than 6 months in the role, Pelly has already made an impact. With the 2016 schedule being congested in the summer due to the Olympic Games next August, the WGC Bridgestone Invitational was set to clash with the Open de France, which is one of the most important and historic events on the European Tour. In addition, of course, being played at the Le Golf National, which is, of course, the host course of the 2018 Ryder Cup. And recognizing the need to support this vital tournament, Pelly announced, no doubt to the extreme frustration of PGA Tour Commissioner Tim Fincham, that the WGC played at the astonishingly dull Firestone Country Club. I'm sorry, Fred, but it is. With no feature.
Which is in Ohio, by the way.
It is in Ohio, but the golf course is terrible. But it would not feature on the European Tour schedule. And next year will be the 100th edition of the tournament in Paris. And last month, Pelly announced further enhancements to it. Prize money has been increased by €500,000 to €3.5 million, while Ryder Cup qualification points have also been increased for both the European and the world's points lists. And having consulted the players in recent months, Pelly also reevaluated the membership requirements of the tour, which had previously required players to participate in 13 European Tour sanctioned events, which included majors and World Golf Championships. However, recognizing this was a disadvantage to players outside of the top 50 in the world rankings, Pelly revised the requirements to be just 5 events on the tour, not including the majors and the WGCs. And this will make it easier for players to balance both tours and to potentially qualify for the Ryder Cup, while also assisting events such as the BMW PGA Championship, the Irish Open, and indeed the Scottish Open. And moving back to that previous point in the French Open, to further entice players from competing in Fred's beloved Ohio, the Open de France will now count for two of those five events. The French Open now is certain to have one of its strongest ever fields next July, thanks to the imaginative thinking of Keith Pelley. And of course, I was on a show months ago and I spoke about this, but I did disagree with his decision to grant Rory McIlroy a pass into the race to Dubai, despite not having played the required number of events. But I fully understand why he did so. From a commercial standpoint, the sponsors and broadcasters wanted Rory involved in the final series, and that is exactly what they got with him winning the season-ending DP World Tour Championship. And we've discussed this, we've talked this before in the show, and the tour has a number of long-standing issues. And I do believe that further alignment with the Asian and PGA of Australian tours is a necessity to create a strong all-world tour outside of America to compete against the PGA Tour. And Keith Pelley has stated recently that it is his ambition to make the circuit a viable alternative to the PGA Tour within the next 5 years with increased prize money and a player-first policy and decision-making. You're personable and engaging. And also an Elton John lookalike, I believe that Pelley will enhance the European Tour during his time in charge. Whether he quite reaches the lofty goal of challenging the PGA Tour is questionable, but I certainly think he has the right ideas and vision to make that a possibility. For far too long now, Tim Fincham and his incredibly dull personality has had it all his own way in the world of golf. And you know, with Keith Pelley there, that may just be about to change. And Mike, what do you think about Keith Pelley as the European Tour CEO?
Well, you've given quite a summary. You've taken a few of my points, which is fine. It's a pleasure to get educated on Keith Pelley. I think his North American special events and broadcast experience is a big plus.
Yes.
So he's got the North American roots. He's now living in Europe, and he's obviously very media savvy. And I congratulate him on his efforts with the putting the French Open in a loftier status, especially since that course will be used in 2018 for the Ryder Cup. So kudos to him. He's got a great property. I lived in England from 1977 to 81, watched a lot of PGA Tour events. I remember watching a young Nick Faldo on TV when he was 17 years old, thinking, like, that guy's got a long way to go. So we need the European Tour to be strong. It helps the overall professional golf scene in the world. And it helps the PGA Tour. I know a lot of players have sort of got great experience by playing over there and winning over there and then have come back here. But while they may do that, we still need that European Tour to be strong, and we've got a great leader in Keith, and I know he'll do well. Fred?
Yeah, Pelley definitely has his hands full. We've talked about it on the show over the last couple of months. He is a media expert, and he will need to leverage that experience to keep the European Tour relevant over the next few years. You know, he's demonstrated that he will not shy away from the important decisions with the Rory thing, with the Open de France thing. So, you know, and he appears to be imaginative, you know, upping the ante on the French Open. That's good stuff. Bottom line is he needs to keep increasing purses, so he's got to keep finding new sponsors. He needs to keep that European talent in Europe as much as possible. And, Kieran, I agree with you 100%. They need to take the positive of being an all-world tour and combining more with Australia, with Asia, and really selling that to the world golf scene as a whole to make it viable. Carlos?
And I think in 2016 we'll see a lot of what is going to be coming soon for the European Tour and what Keith Pelley is going to be bringing. Well, now it's time for number 10, and this one is going to be taken by Fred. Fred, last year, Werner Langer, he made our top stories of the year by winning the Charles Schwab Cup, and he wins it in back-to-back years again. He's number 10. How about that win again from him?
Well, you know, Bernd Langer had a great career on the European Tour and in the States on the PGA Tour, but he has just gone hog wild in his 8 years on the Champions Tour. We have been talking about Bernd Langer all year long. Matter of fact, we've been talking about him for almost the whole 3 years that we've been doing this show. In 2016, Langer, now 56, I'm sorry, in 2015, Langer, now 57 years old, had two wins, five runners-up, two third-place finishes, and 13 top tens in 19 starts. That is consistency at its finest. He finished inside the top 10 in 68% of his starts this year. Unheard of. Do you have any idea how difficult it is to finish top 10 in a professional golf tournament? Throw in the fact that his competitors have been some of the best players in the world for over 30 years, and there are over 80 guys in the field each week that are trying to win. Extremely difficult. Colin Montgomery and Jeff Maggart led the Charles Schwab Cup standings for most of the year, while Longinger seemingly finished top 10 every week. Maggart jumped to the early lead with wins in two of the first three majors on the Champions Tour at the Traditions and the U.S. Senior Open. He added two more wins at the Shaw Charity Classic and the Dick's Sporting Goods Open. Injuries curtailed his play at the end of the season, and he could only muster one more top 10 finish in his last five starts after Labor Day. Montgomery only had one win for the year, but it was a big one. He won the Senior PGA at French Lick and added a total of 13 top 10 finishes for the season. Monty and Maggart had a huge lead in the Charles Schwab Cup race until Longer made his move at the end of the year. His win at San Antonio with just 2 weeks remaining in the season put him close to the leaders, and his runner-up finish in the Charles Schwab Cup Championship, losing in a playoff to Billy Andrade at the final event of the year, moved him past Monty and Maggart for the million-dollar bonus. Longer becomes the first Champions Tour player to win the Charles Schwab Cup three times in just 8 years. In the years that he did not win the Charles Schwab Cup, he has two runners-up, a third and a fourth. The only year he finished outside the top five was 2011, when he missed a large part of the year due to a thumb injury. The Champions Tour had another great season in 2015. Billy Andrade announced his presence on the senior circuit with three wins and seven top tens to finish at number four in the Charles Schwab Cup race. Andrade looks like a sure bet to contend for majors and the Cup next season. What about Davis Love? He's still winning on the regular tour, even though he's 51 years old. He would bring a lot of excitement to the Champions Tour if he decides to play more next season. The kicker is always Freddie Couples. Men want to be him, and the women want to be with him. He's the biggest draw every week he plays. If his back would hold out, he could be a huge factor next season. For the moment, though, Bernhard Langer is the man on the Champions Tour that everyone is chasing. Will he be the first to win four Charles Schwab Cups in 2016, guys?
Well, I think you look at Bernhard Langer and the incredible success he's had in the Champions Tour is remarkable, given that most players in the Champions Tour have their great success early on. After they turn 50, they're fresh on the tour, they're rejuvenated by that prospect of almost being the rookie on the circuit. But Langer's maintained that consistency now for almost a decade. Of course, he's 58 years old, and he is super fit. He looks after himself. He's probably in some ways almost as good a player as he was 10, 15, 20 years ago. And I also go back to the performance last year he had in the Senior Open Championship at Royal Porthcawl, which was one of the best performances of any tour last season. The golf he played in that really burnt out firm links course was just stunning. And he's a great practitioner on the course. He maps his way around the layouts, and he takes far too long to play, of course. It's always been a criticism of Bernhard, but he's got a fantastic mentality, terrific experience, and he has an unusual swing, but it works for him, and that's what matters. It's not what we would call textbook or orthodox, but in the end, what does that even mean? He has the perfect impact positions, and with his long putter, of course, he's had great success with that. As Fred says, the challenge for him will be next year, whether he can overcome the anchored putting ban. I saw an interview today with him with Michael Collins of ESPN. He has confessed that he hasn't even really thought about it yet, what he's going to do without the anchored putter. Of course, he's done it for the last 19 years now. Bernhard has had great, tremendous problems with the yips in the past, but despite that, he was able to win the Masters twice with the yips, which is incredible. Because he had a variety of different grips. He occasionally would have left below right, the claw grip. He also had a Kuchar-style grip with the putter against the forearm, which, kind of an odd reason, somewhat unclear, is still legal under the new rule, which, as Dottie Pepper, in a fantastic article I urge you all to read, put out today, was one of the somewhat ambiguous elements to the new rule change, which has certainly been controversial in the last couple of years. But Langer is a fantastic player who somehow finds a way to win against all circumstances. Back in the early 80s, when he was a young guy, he had the yips, and he would hit every fairway, every green, and then he would hit 10-foot putts 40 feet past the hole. You know, he was racked, riddled with the yips back then. And despite that, he's had a Hall of Famer career. And for me, Barrett Langer has shown in the past that he's capable of overcoming these obstacles and still being a great player and being successful. And I think he can probably do it again. You know, he has that great mentality. And but of course, one guy who will be hoping that isn't the case is Colin Montgomery, who will be gunning for Bird next season. But you know, Langer's a fantastic player. You know, such a long career now, great longevity in the game, and perhaps some ways somewhat underrated. You know, we think Faldo and Seve in that era, Langer was a little bit under the radar, perhaps due to being a bit more of a subdued personality. But he's a fantastic player, and I see him having success in the future, even with the Anchor's putting ban coming in.
I'd have to agree with all what you guys said. You know, since I lived in Europe for a few years, I saw Langer over there, and I followed his career since I've been back in the U.S. since 1981. The thing that stands out for me with Langer is his fitness. He takes care of himself, and he doesn't look 57, 58, or whatever he is, and he doesn't act that way. He doesn't swing that way. He keeps himself supple and loose and fit, and he's mentally sharp. That German concentration, that German focus has been able to get him through tough stretches in life. And I think the only thing that he's really done sort of poorly in the last few years was, unfortunately, he had that issue in the Senior British Open last summer when he put his, I think his approach shot on 18 into a greenside bunker and took two to get out, and ended up losing to Mark Wiebe. Had he been able to just get out and just make bogey, I think he would have won that by a stroke. And I think that that one miscue, I think, really helped motivate him throughout this past year. And I look for more of the same from Langer. We saw the same thing from Hale Irwin. And we've seen a lot of those great, strong performances from Tom Watson, who at 59 almost won a British Open. So look for us to be talking with as much praise and admiration a year from now about Langer as we are today. So he's quite a player, and he's got some, you know, sunny days in front of him.
25 victories, 5 PGA Tour Champions Tour Player of the Year awards, and 3 Charles Schwab Cup, and a lot of challengers coming on next year. So let's see how he does. He definitely fits the bill as a great player there on the Champions Tour. So now let's go on to number 9, and Mike is going to take this one. It's about the President's Cup that makes it at number 9. What a thrilling close finish there. All the rules changes. Mike, how about the President's Cup making it into number 9?
Great drama. If you look at the, of course, we won, and it's I think it's only appropriate that Bill Haas, the son of our captain Jay Haas, ended up making the winning putt over Sangmun Bae and won his last singles match 2 up, and we end up winning 15.5 to 14.5. But many people probably don't realize that you know, the event began on Thursday, the Thursday of that week, and we had foursomes, which traditionally is not an American strength. But we actually won 4 matches, and we lost 1. And then going into the Saturday four ball, which is where everybody hits their shot, you've got 4 balls going through, and that's usually our strength. We actually lost that 3.5 to 1.5. So going into Saturday morning, we had a 5.5 to 4.5 lead, single point. Saturday morning's matches, foursomes, we tied 2-2. Saturday afternoon's four ball matches, we tied 2-2. And then going into Sunday singles, 12 matches, we tied 6-6. So it was pretty close the last 3 sessions. In fact, it was dead even. And it was all won on the Thursday afternoon foursome matches, and we got out of the gate quickly. Watson Holmes won their initial match 3-2 over Scott and Matsuyama. Kuchar and Reed lost 3-2. And then the 3 closing matches, we had Fowler and Wall, Zach Johnson, and Spieth and Dustin Johnson all win their matches, giving us that 4-1 lead going into Friday, and we just hung on throughout the weekend. As for the President's Cup, it's been held nearly every year in this country. Of course, it's been held in South Africa. I've got another phone call. I'm going to get rid of that phone call. I apologize for that ring. But it's been in South Africa, it's been in Australia, and now it's been in South Korea. It's a great international event. Doesn't quite have the enthusiasm yet of the Ryder Cup, but it gives our players great, you know, team golf experience. And, you know, as far as watching on television on the East Coast, you had to sort of stay up late and stay up into the wee hours of the morning. But if you lived in California, West Coast, the hours are pretty conducive, as they would have been if you lived in Hawaii. So it was a great event for global golf, great event for American golf because we won. And it was a great feel-good story because Bill Haas was a bit of a controversial pick because his dad, Jay, was the captain, but it turned out to be a great pick because Bill won the game, the match-winning putt on the last day. So I think it gives us momentum going to the Ryder Cup, and I think we're cautiously confident going into Minnesota next fall. Gentlemen?
Yeah, you know, for me, youth is a story, and, you know, we're going to be talking more about that later. But, you know, the international team made up of Danny Lee, Hideki Matsuyama, Honor Ben Lahiri, Jason Day, Brandon Grace, Sang Mumbai, they get some great young guys to build this international team around. And I really think that was a story. That and the rules changes really made a big difference in the President's Cup. 15.5 to 14.5, just a one-point differential. You know, the PGA Tour really needed a more competitive international President's Cup team, and they got it. Another big plus here was, as you mentioned, holding it in Korea. Asia as a whole is just golf crazy. It was a good move to get this event to Korea, get our guys over there. As you know, our guys are pretty reluctant to travel internationally unless there's a big payday, a big appearance fee dangling out there at the end of it. So this thing ended up being a home run and really makes it look a lot better for 2 years from now. Kieran?
Yeah, you know, I've long kind of derided the President's Cup for a variety of reasons. I think it's just basically an extension of Tim Finch's ego. In the reality of it, he controls most of the most important events in the game, obviously not the major championships, and not the Ryder Cup either. So, you know, Fincham has the strongest tour, he has the Players' Championship, but he doesn't have a major, he doesn't have the Ryder Cup, the five most important events in the game. So he created the President's Cup to try and counteract that fact. And it's long struggled, mostly because ultimately the international team is a very disparate group of people. It's hard to have a connection if you're from South Korea playing with a guy from Argentina or Australia. It's difficult to have that. And probably the only two times I've really had that connection were probably in South Africa. In 2003 we had the famous tie, and back in 98 when the international team won in Australia under Peter Thompson. So, but I think this time it was different. I think the format change was a positive one, and I think it was a necessary one. We had some present international players threatening not even to play in the tournament if the changes were not made. And I think it certainly enhanced the event. It became a very good spectacle on that final day. It was certainly great drama. So, you know, for the fans in South Korea, of course, to see that, obviously it was fantastic to watch golf up close, which they, of course, are really into. And so I think it had the President's Cup in many ways. It doesn't have the history of the Ryder Cup. It doesn't have the rivalry of the Ryder Cup either. But what it does have is it can be an exhibition in its own sense. The President's Cup has got an issue where it's neither a really hotly contested competition like the Ryder Cup is, and it doesn't act like an exhibition either. It should act like one or the other. And it can be a fantastic exhibition going around the world trying to, you know, bring top-level golf to various parts of the globe, and that can be a positive thing. But from a pure entertainment standpoint, this President's Cup was certainly one of the best I've had for a long time, probably since 2003, and hopefully the one in 2 years' time will be equally as entertaining. And I think also internationals, it's crucial they get Nick Price back in as captain because he's had a real effect on those players. He's a very popular, very likable man, one of the great gentlemen of the game, a fantastic experience, of course. And I think he's brought all these young players together and given them the foundation to go out there and express their fantastic skills as players. Because international players are obviously, you know, they are fantastic, and, you know, and many young players, particularly Louis Westhuizen as well, leading those players as more of the senior head. And I think they've got a very good team going forward, and hopefully we can see most of those players back in the side next time, and they can certainly give the Americans a good challenge. But going forward, the internationals have to remain competitive and even win one of these events, particularly in America, if it's to become a real hotly contested event, but it was certainly a good exhibition. I enjoyed following it.
And that one will be in 2017 in Liberty National at New Jersey. And like Kieran said, it may not have the history, it may not have the rivalry, but this year those rules changes really made some difference, and you might all remember what it did to the Ryder Cup. So now let's take our first short break, and when we come back, we're going to have number 8.
Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to visit www.edraft.com for analysis, breaking news, and more. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter at edraftsports and on Facebook at facebook.com/edraftsports. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and we're counting down the 2015 top 12 stories of the year in golf. And now we're up to number 8. Kieran has this. We talked about the President's Cup. Another team competition makes it now at number 8. This time with the ladies. It's the Solheim Cup. A historic comeback there by the U.S., capped by Suzanne Peterson's Gimme Gay. Kieran, how about that win and the event in the Solheim Cup?
Well, it was certainly contentious, that's for sure. And Europe were seeking an unprecedented hat-trick of Solheim Cup victories, having won in Ireland in 2011 and dominating in Colorado 2 years ago. And after a halved opening session at St. Leon Roth in Germany, Karen Koch's team edged ahead in the afternoon with Anna Nordqvist and Caroline Hedvall easing past Morgan Pressel and Paula Creamer to take the first of the four-ball matches, with Charlie Hull and Gladys Nocera defeating Alison Lee and Angela Stanford. However, play was then suspended due to a thunderstorm, with the final two matches of that session being concluded on Saturday morning. And both of those matches were halved, with Europe taking a two-point lead into the third session of foursomes in the afternoon. And they would extend that lead by winning three of those 4 points, moving 4 points ahead going into the afternoon. It's starting to look reminiscent of the match 2 years previously, with Julie Inkster's players struggling to gain a foothold in the event. And Lexi Thompson and Christy Kerr earned a priceless victory for the Americans, though, over Azahara Munoz and Carlota Saganda, while Stacey Lewis and Jirina Pillar narrowly defeated Caroline Masson and an out-of-form Caroline Hedvall. However, darkness would descend upon the course once again, a theme of this of the weekend, and play would roll over to Sunday, and what a day that would promise to be. It was Karine Isher and Katrina Matthew and Pedersen, Susan Pedersen and Charlie Hull taking the points to take Europe into a four-point lead going into the singles, meaning that the United States required a record comeback in the history of the competition to potentially win the trophy. A massive ask. But did they do it? Well, we will find out, of course. However, it would be that final match involving Susan Pedersen, Charlie Hull, that caused the biggest stir of the weekend and was ultimately the leading story from the week, unfortunately. Suzanne Pedersen and Charlie Hull moved one up on the 17th hole over Alison Lee and Brittany Lincecum after Lee picked her ball up on the green after mistakenly believing that it had been conceded by Pedersen and Hull. This led to contentious scenes and tears from younger players, Lee and Hull, with the Europeans refusing to back down over this issue, and they would subsequently win the last hole as well for a two-up win in that session. And anger ensued from the American players and Captain Inkster, with many believing that Pedersen, as the senior player of that partnership, was unsporting, with Lee stating that she believed that the putt had been conceded, with the two European players and their caddies walking away from the green. There was a lot of finger-pointing and contention, but at the same time, I have to be fair about this, Alison Lee herself should have known better and made absolutely certain that the putt was or was not conceded. Perhaps that was naive inexperience on her part. From the standpoint of the rules, Pedersen and Hull did nothing wrong. But the ethics can certainly be argued, and they definitely were in the aftermath of it. However, what is undeniable was that there was a sense of injustice that drove the Americans during the singles matches. Morgan Pressel, Alison Lee, Jirina Pillar, Lizette Salas, Angela Stanford, Christy Kerr, Michelle Wee, and Paula Creamer all won their matches, with Stanford's point against the now apparently villainous Pedersen being her first point in 10 matches. And Creamer, who was a controversial pick from Inkster, having had a terrible year in the LPGA Tour, she clinched the vital point to complete a miraculous comeback by 14.5 to 13.5 and secure the United States the Solheim Cup once again in the most dramatic scenes imaginable. And apart from a Carly Masson 12-foot putt to retain the trophy, Europe were completely swamped by a tremendous surge from the Americans and energy as Julie Engster's team showed a determined spirit that had perhaps been lacking in previous years. Maybe this kind of injustice drove them together and made them more determined to win back the trophy. I think that's undeniable. And controversial and certainly dramatic, Sunday was undoubtedly theatrical. However, the concession incident did overshadow the event, I believe, unfortunately. And unlike the 1969 Ryder Cup, of course, of Jacqueline and Nicholas, it was not overshadowed in a positive light, which is extremely unfortunate for what was an otherwise entertaining showpiece for women's golf that week. And the Solheim Cup is growing all the time, and I'm sure it will be even more contested in 2 years' time when the teams meet again. But it was certainly a controversial, incident-packed, but in the end, drama. And we watched sport for the drama, and there was no doubt, Mike, that the Solheim Cup this year was certainly dramatic.
Indeed. I think we look at the Solheim Cup, it was a one-point difference. We look at the President's Cup, one-point difference. It just shows you the parity and balance that we have in global golf, whether it's men, women, Europe, Asia, America. It's tremendous. Another thing that we can learn, we amateurs can learn from watching these pros and these team competitions, is you can learn strategy and how to play match play. Because a lot of us play match play at our clubs, and one thing I've learned is, in match play, don't take a shot until you have to. A lot of players just play quickly. But be very methodical about and strategic about how you, where you hit the ball, when you take the shot. If this is an issue where you're trying to get the hole over and done with as quickly as possible, you're trying to learn. And we can learn a lot from these pros because they're not getting paid much more than their expenses when they represent their countries. Again, golf was a big winner. Unfortunately, the great competition was overshadowed by the controversy, as they say in England, with that that one putt on 17 that there was confusion whether it should have been conceded or given. But it did show that the girls care, and they're serious about it. And, again, great for world golf, and I know they're looking forward to the next Solheim Cup just as much as we're looking forward to the next Ryder Cup come September in Minnesota. Fred?
Yeah, the controversy with Suzanne Pettersson and Allyson Lee, you know, was the puck conceded or not? Yeah, that got really blown out of proportion. The bottom line is, you know, yeah, Allyson Lee is the only rookie out there, but you know what? You don't pick it up until they actually tell you to. So, you know, to me it was her fault, but you know, it really got blown out of proportion. It made great drama.
And one last point, Fred, there, I must say. Sorry.
Yeah.
I must quickly say, Fred, that the total witch hunt from the media to Suzanne Pettersson was ridiculous over that entire issue. The Golf Channel were acting in a completely ridiculously partisan, unjournalistic manner about this. You'd think she'd murdered a baby on the golf course the way they were going on about it. You know, it was a simple issue, a mistake from Allyson Lee that was blown out, as you say, out of proportions. But the way the media covered it was completely it was unacceptable from a balance standpoint from both sides.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, Kieran. But, you know, still, the U.S. had to win 8 of 12 matches on Sunday to avoid losing a third Solheim Cup in a row. You know, and bottom line is the LPGA once again hits a home run for women's golf. Of course, the latest European Tour is involved also, but, you know, the heated exchanges, the come-from-behind win, the close matches, everything you could ask for in an international team match, the Solheim Cup had it. You know, again, and I keep harping on youth, but, you know, Charlie Hall, she's going to have her second year on the LPGA Tour this year. Had an okay year, nothing fantastic, but she went 4-0 in that Solheim. You know, I'm still looking for her to bust out and go on a tear on the LPGA Tour, and it's going to happen next year, guys. You watch. Also, Allyson Lee just played fantastic golf, a young player right out of school. So, you know, we got a lot of stuff to look forward to. Can't wait for Des Moines in 2017, Carlos.
We're all already counting down to that 15th edition, which will return to the Midwest in 2017, and that will be at the Des Moines Golf and Country Club, which was the home of the 1999 U.S. Senior Open Championship, which drew a record 252,000 spectators. It will now be hosting the event, the most exciting event in women's professional golf. But now we must turn to another story. And, you know, when Charles Schwartzel made that thrilling four birdies in the last four holes at Augusta to leave Rory McIlroy almost in tears and won the Masters, many of the players that were vying then for the AJ hardware are now taking home PGA Tour trophies with an alarming frequency. Making it at number seven is the youth movement at both the PGA Tour and the LPGA, where Fred is going to tell us about the 20-somethings ruling golf.
Guys, I'm really excited about this topic. You know, I could run way over my allotted time here. I know Carlos has got the mute button. He'll shut me off. But, you know, the youth movement on the PGA and LPGA tours, as well as the rest of the world right now, they're just taking over. The last couple years have been unprecedented in golfing history. 2015 will go down in history as the year that young players took control of the game and signaled the end of the Phil Mickelson-Tiger Woods era on the PGA Tour. Lydia Ko began her era in women's golf a couple of years ago and continued to impress and grow her legend in women's golf this year. At 21 years of age, Jordan Spieth won two majors and nearly added a third at St. Andrews in the Open Championship. He won three more times on tour and eclipsed $12 million in prize money. Oh, yeah, by the way, plus he added that little $10 million check at the FedEx Cup, ascended to the number one spot in the world, only made $22 million total prize money for the year. You know, not even a guy named Tiger Woods earned that much in prize money in one year. Rory McIlroy's untimely ankle injury playing footy cost him some starts, and he lost his number one world ranking to Spieth. He turns 26 this year and appears ready to battle Spieth and Day to regain his number one ranking. Speaking of Jason Day, what a year for the Aussie. He won a ton of fans with his performance at Chambers Bay battling vertigo, claimed his first major at Whistling Straits in the PGA Championship, and then went on to win two of the first three FedEx Cup playoff events at the Barclays and the BMW Championship. He just turned 28 and has firmly entrenched himself in the conversation as one of the best young players in the world right now. Many, of course, are touting Spieth, McIlroy, Day as the new big three in golf, but Ricky Fowler's name keeps popping up as a fourth member of that group. Ricky, 27-year-old, thrilled everyone with his run down the stretch at the Players' Championship in May, backed that up with a win in the FedEx Cup playoffs at the Deutsche Bank, and solidified his claim as one of the young guns on tour. There are simply too many young players to mention in this segment, but a few names to watch next year are Emiliano Grillo's, Carlos's favorite, Smiley Kaufman, and Justin Thomas, who all have won already in the wraparound schedule this fall. 22-year-old Daniel Berger was named 2015 Rookie of the Year. Patrick Rogers has had a great fall, and the hits just keep on coming. With the abundance of youth on the PGA Tour, perhaps the LPGA is even more blessed with young, talented players right now. Lydia Ko, all of 18 years old, just wrapped up her second consecutive race to the CME Globe and the million-dollar bonus that goes with it. In addition, she was the LPGA Player of the Year, coming off her Rookie of the Year performance last year. She continues to set the youngest ever to win a major title when she won the Evian Championship and youngest ever to win 10 professional tour events. In 2 years on the LPGA Tour, Ko has won 8 titles, including a major, and earned over $7 million. Lydia's going to need to keep the pedal down on the accelerator, however. There are more talented young women ready to win on tour, and in fact, the first 13 events of the LPGA Tour season, only one of those was won by someone over the age of 30. Astonishing fact here, Enby Park, who has earned enough points for induction into the LPGA Hall of Fame, is only 27 years old. Rookie of the Year, 22-year-old Se-Young Kim, won 3 titles and finished the year at number 6 in the race in the CME Globe standings. Lexi Thompson was much more consistent this season and ended the year at number 3. in the race to the globe and number four in the world. In addition to Lydia, Envy, and Lexi, of the top 10 on the Rolex ranking, only Stacy Lewis has reached the age of 30. One of our favorite stories all year was Canadian Brooke Henderson, who began the year with no status on any tour because she was under the age of 18. She earned her Symetra card mid-season with a win in South Bend, finished top five in both the KPMG Women's PGA and U.S. Women's Open, plus won in Portland to earn her full LPGA Tour membership. Let's talk about the U.S. Women's Open winner and number 10 in the world, 21-year-old NG Chung. She has to be the odds-on favorite to be the Rookie of the Year in 2016. She won five events in Korea this year, two in Japan, and the U.S. Women's Open. And let's not forget Minji Lee, only 19, got her first win this year at Kings Mill. Oh, remember this Michelle Wee girl? She just turned 26 in October. This is just the tip of the iceberg, guys. I could go on for hours. With great coaching in junior golf and experience playing AGG events as well as in college, the talent just keeps getting deeper and younger. LPGA rules state that women under the age of 18 must petition for tour membership, and Commissioner Michael Wan is trying to keep a lid on and force some women to attend at least 1 year of college before coming out on tour. But when they win, like Lexi or Brooke Henderson or Lydia have done, it's impossible to keep them off the tour. The future of the PGA Tour and the LPGA Tour has never looked brighter, guys. I can't wait until January to see what's in store for us in 2016. Kieran, can you believe all the young players in the world right now?
Well, it's incredible, and you summed up brilliantly there, Fred, in both tours. And and we see the game becoming more international all the time. More players, particularly in Asia, of course, in the LPGA, playing golf at a young age and becoming fantastic players in their teens. You know, that's going to happen on the PGA Tour as well. We're going to see more players from Asia cross over to America in the coming years. Obviously, we've seen Hideki Matsuyama is probably the most prominent example of that at the moment from Japan. But I think as well, the demographics in both tours are slightly different. The LPGA has always been somewhat younger than the PGA Tour. And this is perhaps why the shift in the men's game is perhaps more noted, because for the past sort of 12, 15 years, we've had an era that was essentially Tiger Woods, then with Phil Mickelson behind him, Vijay Singh, Ernie Els, Retief Goosen, Davis Love, Jim Furyk, guys like that who were there at the top for essentially a decade in various capacities. And while in the LPGA at that same time, we've had a variety of eras as well. Obviously, Annika Sorenstam was then succeeded by Lorena Ochoa. Then it was Yanni Singh. And then it was MB Park. And now it's potentially Lydia Ko, who's doing obviously astonishing things in her career to this point. So we're seeing a real shift on both sides where, I think in many ways as well, also important to note is many of these young players are almost directly following in the footsteps of all of the great players before them. We look at Rory, we look at Jason Day, Jordan Spieth, those guys are all born essentially in golf from the Tiger Woods generation. You know, Rory and Jason Day in particular have spoken about how much Tiger is an idol of theirs, how much was their inspiration when they were young kids, because when Tiger was at their best, they were only 10, 11, 12 years old. And we're now seeing the fruit from that, and that will only continue. And this is why we're seeing so many great young players coming on to the men's game. Justin Thomas, as you said there. One guy you didn't mention, Fred, I think will be a real breakthrough year next year is Matt Fitzpatrick from England, who obviously won the British Masters, performed consistently throughout the season. And I think he has all the tools to potentially be one of the leading players in the game, and I expect him to really push on next season. And on the LPGA, we're seeing the Korean players obviously started with Seo Ri Pak in the late 90s, and we're seeing that generation coming through. Them, the role models are always there. And the coaching, the investment obviously is important in the game, and that's how you hone the skills of young players. But the most important thing is getting them involved. And how do you get them involved is having the role models there for them to inspire them to get into the game. And we've had that in the men's game for the past 20 years with Tiger, Phil, those kind of guys. We've seen Rory, Jason Day come from that. And now on the LPGA, we're saying the same thing, where Seo Ri Pak, Lorena Ochoa, Annika, they have inspired a massive generation of young girls and young ladies getting involved in the game, and that will only continue in the next 4 to 5 years. And I really expect us now to see a real generation shift in the game on both genders, and it's going to be really exciting to watch. And Mike, and I'm sure you're equally enthralled by the prospect of all these young players going head-to-head in the coming years.
It's
it's stunning. We probably never thought we'd see the end of the Phil and Tiger era. And I'm not discounting Phil Mickelson from winning another major, but he's got to get fit. He's got to get strong and supple. And though Tiger, we'll see. But as far as the youth movement, the one guy you guys have not talked about, and he's going to be the focus of my short discussion, Brooks Koepka. He won the Turkish Airlines Open in November of last year, then came back and won on the PGA Tour at Phoenix on Super Bowl Sunday, on the same day that the Seahawks and the Patriots met across town. This young man I've known since birth. He lives just a few miles from me. I remember seeing him in the cradle when he was just a week old, and he is now 25, 26 years old, and he's a stud. He can hit it a ton. I've never seen someone hit the ball on the 18th fair on the 18th hole at Honda, which is the PGA National Champions course. Last year he drove through the fairway from the tee into the water, which has got to be a 350-yard hit. I mean, no one ever gets into the water on the 18th tee on your first shot, but Koepka did. He can hit it far. He can hit it straight. He's got a good short game. I mean, a great short game. Phil Mickelson says he doesn't miss a shot. And he got a little injury trouble last year. I think he got injured at Arnold Palmer. He was out for a few weeks. And that's probably why he didn't make the President's Cup team, because he was out for a few weeks and didn't make enough points and still almost qualified. But he's done things the old-fashioned way. He went to Europe, and he knows how to play the game. He's got an incredible maturity about him for someone so young. His demeanor on the course is just like Jack, like Artie. He'll be like a soccer player. He won't be known as Koepka. He'll be known as Brooks, just like Ronaldo and Pele and Messi. And, of course, great golfers are known by their first names, Jack, Arnie, Lee, Gary, Tom, and now we've got Brooks. So you've heard it here first. Do not be surprised if Koepka is in the winner's circle next year in at least one major, and I wouldn't be surprised if they fit him for a green jacket come April.
And one you have to write it down. Mike May said it today, December 15th. Look for Brooks Koepka. But he's definitely a great player, and we look forward to seeing much more of him. And Kieran, I have to thank you for mentioning Matthew Fitzpatrick. I am very high on Emiliano Grillo, but as well I am on Matthew Fitzpatrick. I think that expecting to be a very, very big-time player very soon. And he's going to be a Ryder Cup player for a long time.
I want
time,
you guys to know I did not forget about those two. I just had so many names to talk about. I hated to keep going on and on. I didn't want to leave them out. It's just that there was just so many to talk about.
No, but that's good. Everybody had something to say about somebody, so we went all over, and that's the great thing about this. But hey, let's move on to the next story. Hey, it's Jason Day. He makes it number six. His story from his emergence from vertigo. I remember him overcoming that collapsing with a vertigo attack in the round two to lead through three rounds before running out of gas there at the U.S. Open. So, Mike, how about that emergence from vertigo for Jason Day to become one of the most dominant forces in men's golf at the end of the season?
I mean, while Jordan Spieth definitely grabbed the headlines at the beginning, Jason Day finished up in the headlines towards the end. And boy, had he won the FedEx Cup, he probably would have been the player of the year. I mean, after that disappointment of the British Open, where he came so very close again, he comes back to a few days and dominates in Canada. And that just catapults him through into the in the FedEx playoffs. As Fred said earlier, he won at the Barclays, he won the BMW, but his performance at Whistling Straits was just incredible. We've never seen someone get to minus 20 in a major. Jason Day did that. His worst round at Whistling Straits was a 68, which was that he had the first round, 4-under. He went 68, 67, and then on the weekend he was 67-66 or 66-67, all in the 60s. If you have four rounds in the 60s in a major championship, you nearly always win. And he just was dominant. And I've never seen someone swing the club so hard with so much energy and yet hit the ball square time and time again. His short game is second to none. He is there's no reason why he won't go down to one of the game's great players. I think this, the getting over the hurdle of the first win is I could see Koepka and Day battling out on the last nine, the last group, on the 10th or 11th of April, whenever that Sunday is of the Masters. Both guys can hit it a ton. But Jason's overcome a lot. He had a troubled childhood in Australia, and for someone to do as well as he has done, given the difficulties he had to grow up in. I mean, he didn't grow up in a country club household. He didn't grow up where everything was provided. I mean, it was a hard, tough life, and he just persevered and had people champion his cause. And his caddy is, I think, his coach for a long time. And again, with the vertigo, he still finished, I believe, 10th of U.S. Open. My word, it's a situation where his mental toughness was almost able to overcome the physical disability of what vertigo can do. I've never suffered from it. Hopefully I never will. But for him to come back and play as well as he did and not withdraw, many people would have withdrawn, and it would have been understandable. But Day has got that dog-fighting, bulldog attitude where he's had to earn every single thing he's had in life. And I think, frankly, the perseverance he had at the U.S. Open was the reason he did so well later in the year, because he could always draw from that, knowing, given the situation I was in, I still finished, I believe, 10th at the U.S. Open. I can win these other things, despite the disappointment at St. Andrews. Come to Canada and just run the gauntlet. And he played at a level of golf that very few of us have ever seen or will ever see again. But, again, he's got to be a favorite to win at Augusta, as well as any of the other major championships in 2016 and beyond. Again, I could go on and on. I don't want to steal the thunder. I'll pass it on to Fred for his thoughts on the great Jason Day.
Well, I'm not, you know, he just had a phenomenal year. It was great to watch him. He's been improving every year. He works really hard with Colin, his caddy, teacher, guru, father figure, whatever you want to call him. They're very close, and they sit down every year, decide what they're going to do to improve. And he has a system, and he sticks to it. He swings hard on every shot, and that's his game. I do want to, for the record, note that Jason Day does reside in Columbus, Ohio, guys. I just had to do it. By the way, you know, Mike mentioned about his life in Australia and growing up. The video on YouTube is outstanding. If you go to YouTube and search for Never Say Die, the Jason Day story, it's outstanding. It's about a 10-minute video. Jason spends a lot of time on camera in it. They talk about everything, how his mother, after his father's death, how his mother sacrificed everything to get him into a school and to get him playing golf. And really good stuff. And I know some people, I know some of Jason's family, and they all speak very highly of him. Very humble, very nice young man. With that, Kieran, I'll turn it over to you, sir.
Yeah, I agree with you about the story and the video, and also the letter that Jason Day wrote to his 12-year-old self in the Players' Tribune a month or two ago was a wonderful read and really insightful and quite emotional and, again, inspiring, because he, as Mike and Fred, you both said there, he overcame an awful lot when he was a young kid and stuff that any young kid should never have to overcome. You're losing your father at 12 years old and falling into the emotional kind of disarray from that, and then for the help of his mother and, of course, Colin, who is, as you say, a father figure for him, to overcome that and become, at one point this year, the number one player in the game and winning a major championship and having a great life in America, of course, with Ellie, his wife, and now two children. It is a wonderful story, and Jason Day represents a great deal of perseverance and determination and, you know, the importance of having good people alongside you who can help you along the way. And I think it's a wonderful story, Jason Day's story. You know, he's been up there for a long time now. We can go back to 2010, actually, at the PGA Championship, Whistling Straits there. He contended as a very young player then. And then he's done that consistently throughout the last 4 years, where almost essentially every single major, Jason Day would felt like he finished in the top four every time. He had the game so clearly to play in the toughest courses and the biggest pressures and to play well under that scrutiny. Maybe there was a confidence aspect or a strategic aspect that was lacking a little bit there mentally, perhaps, of him. But he's grown, he's developed that over time. He's taken advice, including from Tiger Woods. Asked him how he did it throughout the time in his career, and it was a case of, you know, treat every single shot, the first drive on Thursday, treat that exactly the same as the last putt on Sunday, because every shot all counts for the same. And in the end, 72 holes, the winner will be from that. And that's he's now putting the same effort into every single shot that he plays, no matter whether it's a drive on Thursday or a putt on Friday afternoon, or of course the last putt on Sunday. He puts the same scrutiny over each of those shots, and that's why he's had the success that he's had this year. And for this, really, as Mike said, since the Canadian Open, the form he showed really was incredible. And who would have thought that with Jordan Spieth, the year he had winning two majors in the FedEx Cup, people would at one point be almost thinking that Jason Day could challenge him as Player of the Year. That's how well Jason Day played. He was up there. Jordan Spieth had an historic season, one of the greatest ever, and Jason Day was pushing him all the way. And that's a great testament to both of those players. And I look forward to watching him next season going forward. But Jason Day is someone who has an immense talent. He plays almost like Tiger, long off the tee. He's imperious with his irons. And when he gets going, he's a fantastic putter. And he's shown a real mettle under pressure this season, as I saw, of course, being pushed by Spieth at Whistling Straits in August. And Jason Day, as I say, a wonderful story, an inspiring story. And I expect more chapters to be written next season.
And after finishing tied for ninth at the U.S. Open, those eight other tournaments he played, four wins, including the major championship and the PGA championship, he had a T4, a T10, and two ties for 12. So no wonder, like Mike May said, if he would have won the FedEx Cup, probably he would have been winning the Player of the Year. And making it now to the next story at number five. It's another one from the big three, and that's Rory McIlroy. And this one's going to be taken by Kieran. Kieran, almost Player of the Year, Jason Day, and Rory McIlroy just won European Tour Player of the Year. Well, how about that roller coaster year that Rory McIlroy had?
Yeah, Carl, it's been an incredible season for Rory McIlroy in so many ways. And after winning two majors last year, you know, he was widely expected this season to carry that form on and dominate into 2015. And, of course, following his breakup with Caroline Wozniacki last year, just before the PGA at Wentworth, he had talked about this period of his life in his mid to late 20s being his window for success in the game, the period when he would win his majors and really stamp his name in the history of golf. And most people believed that he would build on that resume this season. And it looked like it may be the case, with victory at the Omega Dubai Desert Classic, which of course was his first European Tour win back in 2009, setting him up as being the man to beat at Augusta National, where he was hoping to complete the career Grand Slam and win three successive majors. However, Jordan Spieth would take the headlines at Augusta and win the Masters, while Rory finished in a distant but more than credible fourth place, which was his best finish in the season's opening major. And McIlroy would respond from that loss to his new rival at the top by winning WGC Cadillac Matchplay in San Francisco and then the Wells Fargo Championship, which of course he also won back in 2010. And that placed him in a strong position going into the US Open at the outlandish and unpredictable venue of Chambers Bay. And there McIlroy finished in ninth place. And his top 10 finish was once again overshadowed by Jordan Spieth, who of course won back-to-back majors to edge a step closer to potentially winning the season Grand Slam. However, despite, you know, those good finishes and Jordan Spieth's success, Rory was still the favourite for the Open Championship at St Andrews, a course in which he had enjoyed in the past and declared his favourite in the world. But something unexpected happened. 2 weeks before defending his Open title, Rory ruptured an ankle ligament when playing football with some friends, and it would take him out of the Open and WGC Bridgestone, and left him rusty and untested when he returned quickly, has to be said, at the PGA Championship. And despite that setback, which Rory has now admitted was a reckless mistake in the end, he should not have been playing football in the middle of the season, taking a real risk there. McIlroy performed solidly during the FedEx Cup playoffs, but struggled with the putter. He was a bit sluggish on the greens. However, he looked back to his best during the DP World Tour Championship in Dubai recently, with his driving being imperious. It was incredible. And the putting touch is smooth, as we've seen for a long time from him. And of course, we witnessed that on the 71st hole of the tournament, as he crucially holed a putt to win by a single shot. He held that putt from 30 feet after driving into the water. He recovered and, of course, finished a shot ahead of Andy Sullivan. And when the race to Dubai, and of course, as Carlos, you said there, today being named the European Golfer of the Year, McIlroy has ended the season on a high note. And, of course, there's also been some rumours he has proposed to his girlfriend, Erica Stahl. So things are certainly looking up for young Master Rory. But the injury in the summer was, of course, unfortunate, and it left a real asterisk, a real black mark on the season. And it removed a rare chance to win the Open at St Andrews. But I firmly believe he is now in a position to challenge both Spieth and Jason Day at the summit of the world rankings. They're so close together in the ranking, it's going to be a real hot battle into the new year. And I do think, when Rory is at his best, I believe that he is still the best player in the game. I think his driving is among the finest that we've ever seen in the history of golf. The combination of his length and accuracy is incredible, and his ability to do it time after time after time, particularly in big situations and tough golf courses, sets him apart from most other players. And when he gets the putter sharp, he will win more majors. And I fully expect Rory to return to number one in the new year at some point, and also to win a major championship in 2016. It may even be at Augusta, where he will complete the career Grand Slam. We'll start talking about that, of course, when we get closer to April. But Mike, how would you review Rory's year? You fell behind the headlines made by Spieth and Day, but Rory is still a massive threat.
I think it's in some odd way the injuries that Rory has suffered have helped strengthen the game and made it more competitive. While he had that void, other players have stepped in there to show they too can play. Jason Day, Jordan Spieth, Brooks Koepka, Patrick Reed, etc. So, again, I agree with you. When Rory's firing all cylinders, I think he's still the best. And it's mainly because I think he's the best overall athlete. So Jordan Spieth is a great athlete. Jason Day is a great athlete. So is Koepka, among others. But there's just something about Rory that makes him special. Again, he's, I think, one of only 15 men in the world who've won at least three of the four majors. Jordan Spieth can't say that. Jason Day can't say that. Mickelson's one of those guys. But I think the only major that Mickelson might win would be Augusta. But Rory's going to come out strong this next year. He'll be fit. I think he'll stay away from playing soccer prior to major championships. He'll try to keep that to the off season. Maybe just be the goalie, so to speak. Rory acknowledges that we got some competitive players out there, but when he's at his best and they're at their best, I think he's a stroke better, and we'll see what 2016 brings us. Again, I wouldn't be surprised if the four major winners are not necessarily in this order, but I think McIlroy will grab one, maybe Day, Spieth, and again, my man Koepka. So there's your four winners for next year. Fred?
Man, he just keeps stepping out there on that branch, doesn't he? Oh, man. We're going to have you back on when that baby gets cut off. We'll have to find out what's going on with that. Hey, Rory started out hot. He began the year winning the Omega Dubai on the European Tour in February. He won two events in May. He won the match play, also the Wells Fargo. But no majors in 2015 for Rory. As Kieran documented, fourth in the Masters, ninth at Chambers Bay. Wasn't able to play in the Open Championship at St. Andrews, which has to be a blow because that course is made for him, the way he can drive the ball. And then a 17th at Whistling Straits. He's still pretty rusty coming back there. Wasn't back to form yet. He did get engaged this year. So my question is getting engaged like the same thing as winning a major? Does that compute, or how does that work? the big deal for Rory this year, a little bit questionable, was, you know, he decided, even though he came back, he decided not to play in a couple events he could have played in to get the number he needed to get into the Race to Dubai. But Keith Pelley said, oh, no, that's okay. We're going to exempt you into the Race to Dubai anyhow because we want you to play. Turned out to be a master stroke on Pelley's part. Rory did win in Dubai. It becomes the European Tour Player of the Year and all that good stuff. So, and like Mike said, I think Rory now, losing his number one, has the motivation to regain that number one spot. I mean, he's a competitor. He likes, and that's what Tiger saw early on, and Darren Clark and Graham McDowell saw early on with Rory, that he likes to compete, and that's what drives these guys. They want to be the big dog. They want to be the show dog, so the show pony. So he wants his number one back. So he's got challenges with Spieth and Day, up there for that. So, guys, I really believe that we are on the doorstep of seeing some really great contests at the majors going forward. With these four guys, plus Justin Rose, Adam Scott, and you can go on and on and on, there's going to be some great, great battles at these majors and at these big tournaments going forward.
Rory McIlroy, 20 starts, 4 wins, 1 second place, 6 times in the top 10 after that, and 3 missed cuts. So definitely that win at the DP World Tour Championship sets him up for a great year next year, so looking forward to that, and we'll see what happens. But Rory, I have to agree, when he's on, he's definitely the best player out there. We're going to take another short break, and when we come back, we're going to make it to number 4, so don't go away.
Thank you for listening to the Back Nine Report presented by eDraft.com. We'll be right back. Don't forget to check out our co-hosts on Twitter by clicking their names in the episode description. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and we're counting down the top 12 stories of the year in golf for 2015. And now we're all the way up to number 4. Fred, 27 minutes ago, the GOP main card made it to the news. Everybody's here with us. So we're going to talk about somebody in number 4 that really, at some point in the season for us, we had a special section for him, and you're going to talk about Donald Trump and professional golf, his cause and effect around the world.
Yeah, before I get into that, Carlos, I just want to mention real quickly, I hope all the listeners out there have gone and registered for our winter golf getaway to Gulf Shores. It's a 3-day, 2-night, including a beachfront condo, 54 holes of golf, for a foursome. All they have to do is go to back9blog.com/contest and sign up for that. And we're going to give that away here the beginning of January. They can sign up through December 31st. And that is compliments of Back 9 Media Group and Let's Golf Travel. So back9blog.com/contest. Yes, Carlos, it seemed like every week this year we had a segment on Donald Trump. We started the year with the annual build-up to the WGC Cadillac at Trump Doral, one of Trump's showcases in the world of golf. It continued with his battles with the Irish and Scots over courses he owns and wants to build in those countries, and something about windmills or something about that, I don't know, Flickr, whatever. In between, he has provided media fodder in his preliminary run for the presidential nomination from the Republican Party. One of his main topics is immigrant bashing, and he has made some very inflammatory remarks about that particular subject, which has earned the attention as well as the ire of the PGA, the USGA, the PGA Tour, the LPGA, and the RNA, as well as the European Tour, the big families in the world golfing mafia. Many of Trump's high-end courses have commitments from all of the world's leading tours to host tournaments. Trump made headlines and jump-started his presidential campaign with remarks against illegal Mexican immigration, and it immediately drew the attention of the PGA. They opened the door on Trump losing events when they decided to pull the Grand Slam of golf from Trump National outside of Los Angeles in July. There is, of course, a large Mexican-American contingent in Southern California area, and the Grand Slam could have created a media nightmare for the PGA. The PGA is also scheduled to host two major championships on Trump courses in the next few years. PGA Chief Executive Officer Pete Bovakwa said in August, "The PGA of America is not interested in presidential politics and is involved with Trump as a golf entity. It is taking the senior PGA Championship to one of Trump's courses near Washington, D.C. in 2017 and the PGA Championship to Trump's golf course in Bedminster, New Jersey in 2022. Well, guys, stay tuned for that. I am not sure we've heard the last from the PGA on that subject. I am sure with plenty of time prior to those tournaments, the PGA is hoping that Trump will fall out of the news cycle and they will be able to go on with life as we know it. It was rumored that LPGA considered moving the Rico Women's British Open from Trump Turnberry in Scotland, but due to time constraints, it stayed there, and the historic course was a tremendous venue for the best women golfers. Trump's presence at the tournament was limited to mainly one day, and no real damage to either the event or the LPGA occurred. The Women's British was also meant to be a test run for a return of the Open Championship to Turnberry. Donald, as an ardent golfer, desperately wants one of his venues to host a major championship, and Turnberry appeared to be the most likely. But in recent days, the RNA has announced that due to Trump's remarks demeaning immigration policies specifically pointed at Muslims, they would not consider returning to Turnberry at this time. The latest brouhaha surrounds the WGC Cadillac to be held at Trump Doral in March. Protesters want the PGA Tour to pull the event off Doral due to Trump's comments and involvement with the tournament. He spent over $200 million to renovate the Blue Monster and has become one of the brightest stops on the Florida swing every March. Donald Trump has been a mainstay in women's and men's golf through a very difficult time economically in the U.S. and the world. He has invested millions in course purchases and development. He's been a tireless spokesman for golf and has been recognized as one of the leaders in the golf industry. Most people are unable to separate the golfer from the extravagant showman that makes outlandish statements uttered to raise eyebrows and garner attention. He is the P.T. Barnum of our time and has made a tidy fortune doing so. He many times comes off looking the clown, but he probably laughs all the way to the bank. There is no question Trump has been good for golf in the past. His off-the-wall political statements do not please many minorities around the world, but they seem to strike home with a large portion of the electorate as he continuously leads the polling. This is definitely one of the most intriguing stories of 2015, and I would imagine we will continue to have many more news items concerning Donald Trump and golf in the coming year. Kieran, I know you especially like to talk about Donald Trump.
I must say, I'm only on the show about half a dozen times a year, and every single time this year, I've had to talk about Donald Trump at some point. I think you're doing it deliberately to bother me.
You noticed? Did Trump notice that?
Kieran,
it's very sinister of the two of you by organizing it that way.
Kieran, can you make the point about why Donald Trump wants the windmills or the fans there in Scotland taken out?
Well, he wants them taken out for the simple reason that it would bother his hair for a start. but more than that, obviously he's concerned about the potential visual effect of having wind turbines near his golf course in Aberdeenshire, which I've never been to, in fact. But and of course, Donald Trump claims himself that the golf course is always busy. You can't get a tee time on it. My kind of sources tell me that the golf course is virtually empty most of the time. But Donald Trump is a master brander at his own. He's built this empire around his name, and he's very talented at it, and that's essentially what he's done as a presidential candidate. And he has become a hugely influential figure in the golf industry. And it is problematic. It is problematic when you have someone who is making statements that particularly what he said about Muslims. He was not complaining about or against illegal immigration with Muslims. He was against Muslims as a religion. And that's something different. You are suddenly decrying 1.6 billion people on the planet, lumping them all in the same category. You know, if you were to say we shouldn't take people from a certain country or a certain, well, if they're proven terrorists or anything, that's different. But he lumped them all together into one. And that is problematic for the simple reason that so many of the biggest sponsors in the game now, in the Middle East and around the world, are Muslims. You know, look at the golf courses in Dubai. They are Muslim countries, Muslim-majority countries. And if golf wishes to grow around the planet, it cannot be associated with someone like Donald Trump who makes these statements, because golf has an image problem. It always has. You know, you can go back with the issues in the past of African-Americans not being allowed in certain golf clubs. Augusta National, of course, is a prominent example of that throughout the years of various discriminatory measures to their membership policy, which never was a positive thing for golf at all to be associated with. That, of course, has changed in more recent years, of course, with the recent inclusion of women at Augusta as well. And, of course, the same thing in the Open Championship rotation, of course, with Royal St. George's this year announcing that they have women members in Muirfield as well and so on. So things have changed, and, of course, the RNA most of all. Golf in the 21st century has to be as inclusive as possible. People of all genders, all ages, all races, all religions have to come together, because golf should be that uniting force. It should be a game for everyone. And Donald Trump, unfortunately, does not represent that. It's not even just the racial or the religious comments. Donald Trump has said himself, and this is a direct quote, that golf should be an exclusive game. He believes it should be for the elites, no one else. He has said that. That is not someone you want to associate with the game and to be a prominent figurehead for the sport. And you know, Donald Trump is perfectly entitled to say and believe whatever he wants. I personally don't think he believes half of what he actually says. But, however, the reality is he can say what he likes, but the game of golf itself has the same freedom of expression, the same right to ignore him and to disassociate himself with him. Because the reality is, you know, how far is Trump going to go? He's progressively become more extreme as this whole cycle has continued, and golf has kind of tentatively went around the issue. And if they do not respond to this in a proactive manner, they will be criticized for that. And then, of course, if they actually do that, they'll be criticized for not doing it before. So golf, at the moment, is in a no-win situation. But the only option they realistically have in this particular point is to disassociate themselves with Donald Trump, because he is a negative influence around the world. He may have 40% of the Republican electorate in America on his side, but the vast majority of the world thinks he is a joke, a clown, a very dangerous and, frankly, quite a vile individual. And when you're trying to promote the game in South America, in Latin America, in China, in Asia, in the Middle East, you do not want someone like Donald Trump owning golf courses where the majors are presented, walking around there, making himself seen and shown. That is not something for golf going forward. And you know, we've removed many of the negative things in the past with the Augusta National allowing African-Americans in, allowing women in, courses in Britain now, opening up to female members, as they should. And Donald Trump is the last sort of bastion of bigotry and racial discrimination within golf. And he unfortunately represents the worst excesses of what people perceive golf to be. People perceive golf to be for the elites, for these rich, kind of fat, white guys who nearly don't really care about anyone else, and they look down upon those below them, including minorities. And that's something that is unfortunate, and it's something that golf has to move away from, because in the end, these people may be minorities within the United States, but these people are also the majority of the planet. And you want golf to go around the world, you have to disassociate yourself with Donald Trump, whether he becomes president of the United States or not. He has to go, and the Open should leave Turnberry, the PGA of America should disassociate itself from him in the future, the Ryder Cup, so on, PGA Championships, go somewhere else. There are plenty of golf courses in this country. He may have a lot of money, he may spend it. That does not give him a right to host major championships and to unfortunately taint the game of golf with his negative and rather disparaging remarks about minorities and other people and his wholly unpleasant personality. Golf can do better than that, and it has to.
Don't hold back, Kieran. How do you really feel?
Look, Fred, this is a year of frustration. I've had to let it go. I feel so much better now. It's like a cathartic thing. I've been exercised, the demon of Donald Trump, but I feel great.
Mike, it's your turn, but just to clarify this, he really held back. He really held back here.
I was very
I was impressed with the dialogue, and
you didn't leave one stone unturned, and I wish we should transcribe your comments, put them in a letter, send them to the RNA and the PGA Tour and see what they have to say. I totally understand where Kieran's coming from, but Donald is a polarizing figure. There's no one. He's in a category by himself. And the one good thing about him is he does invest in the game of golf. I know that down here in West Palm Beach area, he's got his first. I think it was his first golf course that he built, and he moved dirt and created mounds, and he's got Trump National. I played the course once. There are some really nice, expensive coconut palms that surround the course, and I know that the local nursery guy who sold Donald those palm trees certainly enjoyed having Donald's money come his way. So while he does sort of have a very exclusive mindset about who plays at his club, he definitely invests in the game. He makes these golf courses top-notch. The local workers earn some money, and he sort of does put golf in a different category, his own category. He's not representative of the rest of the people. He's so unique that, again, he's in a category himself. He doesn't represent all the things about that are regular about golf. He is exclusive. He is somewhat snobbish, but he can afford to be that way. And it's up to the PGA Tour and PGA of America and the RNA whether they want to host their events at his courses. Again, as Kieran said, there's lots of other choices. You don't have to go to his courses, but when he buys a property, he brings it to its fruition. He makes it as good as it can be, and he doesn't mind having a course redesigned as he's done with Doral down in Miami, and it shows itself on TV. One thing about Donald, he's actually a very charitable guy. Remember when was it Rory who threw his pitching wedge in the lake, and Donald hired a scuba diver to go down and get the club and gave it to him the next day. So Donald likes to give sometimes, and he does so in a very humorous way.
Hey, Kieran, what I wanted to mention about Scotland was that you mentioned on the show that Donald Trump wanted to become president so he can send some drones and shoot down the windmill.
So yes, I totally
got it wrong. Now I got it. Now I got the point. So, but that's why. But anyway, Mike, like you mentioned, Donald really invests in the game of golf, and he's really invested in the game more than ever before.
But Carlos, can I make a quick point here about this?
Yes.
Donald Trump invests in golf, and he's bought Trump Turnberry and all the courses in America and around the world he's bought. But the regular person, the average person in the game, cannot afford to go and play his golf courses. They are ridiculously expensive to play. Trump International in Scotland is a extortionate price. Trump Turnberry is even more expensive than it used to be. It's the most expensive course in Britain to play. And this isn't the point is, whether you agree or disagree with his comments is irrelevant in this point. The point is, Donald Trump represents everything that is wrong with the game of golf, and that is something that the governing bodies on the professional circuit and also overall disassociate themselves from. It has not to do with Donald Trump, whether he's a right-wing Republican or not. This is more to do with the fact that he represents everything. He represents the worst stereotypes about the game of golf, and that is something that we have to move on from. Whether he, you can go and play his golf courses if you want, and that's fine. He creates the golf courses for a certain kind of person. Those people are not the majority of the golfing public around the world, and we have to have people who actually represent them. And Donald Trump, unfortunately, is alienating to the vast majority of the world, and that's something that golf cannot be associated with. That's my final word on that.
Well, and with his presidential bid taking his profile now to dimensions, he definitely towered over golf this year in ways that put the sports, like you guys have said, the governing bodies in uncomfortable positions, and it doesn't seem like it will wind down 2016, so we will be all over it as usual. Now, it's time for number three. Last year, Lydia Ko made her top stories at number two. This year, she comes in at number three as she enhanced her emergence as the new dominant force in ladies' golf. But even though she had the big challenge for Green Bay Park, so, Mike, how about Lydia Ko's year?
Lydia Ko, I think she's sort of that hidden story in golf, because it's the LPGA and their season ending event takes place the weekend before Thanksgiving. Now, I've had an opportunity to go to the CME Globe event over at Tiburon Golf Club in Naples the last 2 years, and I've seen her in the press room after having won the season-ending championship now back-to-back years and have that million-dollar bonus. I've never seen an athlete so young, so composed. That's even more amazing than the quality of her golf game, is she's so nonchalant when she sits up there having won the equivalent of the FedEx Cup, and it's the CME Globe Tour Championship. She's done things that Nancy Lopez has never done, and Julie Inkster's never done, and Betsy King never did, and all Kathy Whitworth, et cetera. Of course, some of these season-ending events were not around her, but she has done so much so young, I can't even begin to estimate or forecast where she's going to be by the time she's 25. I know that N.B. Park has qualified for the LPGA, Tours Hall of Fame through the qualifying points by age 27 or so. Well, I think Lily Ko's going to beat that by 3 or 4 years. And she'll have done things by the time she's 22 that most girls don't, ladies don't do by the time they get to 40. And again, she's just so nonchalant. One thing about her that was kind of precious is that I asked her the question. I was the only one to ask this question because I've got rugby in my background. But I asked her what was more important to her and her team after having won a second, CME Globe Tour Championship. What was more important, winning that or having the New Zealanders win the Rugby World Cup on October 31st in London against the Australians? And she was all giddy about that. She said, we were in China, we were trying to follow the internet. Rugby's a big deal in our country. She was more excited about that question and that answer than having won LPGA's greatest tour prize. I mean, she is just incredibly composed, mature, nonchalant, and she's just genuine. And I don't think I've seen an athlete in any sport, especially an individual sport, so natural and not consumed by the money. I mean, she just loves to compete and loves to play well and does so. And, by age 18, she's just started, and she's done more than 90% of most women do in their entire careers. And, she was the first one to, at age 14, she won the Canadian championship, and then at age 15, she defended her title. I mean, that's crazy to be in an LPGA event at 14 and winning it, and then defending it at age 15. Tiger Woods is still trying to, get into junior events in the USGA. And here she is on the pro tour. She's not American, she's New Zealand, so she's miles from home. And she just is relaxed and just wins. And she's got the respect of her fellow tour players, and I can't wait to see what she does next year. Again, she's sort of been under the radar for a while, and she is something else. I mean, had she been a man, probably would have been the top story of the year. I hate to say that, but because she's the LPGA, he's sort of got bumped down a little bit. But I think we need to give her a little more credit. She's a phenom, and she's been more successful than young Rory McIlroy has been. And we're talking about Rory being one of the greatest players ever. So it's, I'd be interested to hear what you guys would say. But again, I've seen her in action, and she's got it going, and she's not nervous. She's composed, and she just can't wait to, get out there and do it again next year. And I'm sure she will. Fred, or is it Kieran? I can't remember who's next.
I just have to echo Mike's comments. We had the chance to interview Lydia in June when she was here to defend her title at the Marathon Classic, and she had many media responsibilities that day. She did put on a clinic for some first tee kids and did some different stuff. And there was a line of media people to talk to her, and photographs and TV and the whole thing. And she was just calm and collected, and just went from. And when I finally got a chance to talk to her, we talked just like there was nobody else around. She was open, forthcoming, at ease. really, you know, she is unique as a 17, 18-year-old person. What Lydia Ko has done over the last 4 years in the world of golf is just simply astonishing. When she turned professional in 2013, she was already number four in the world ranking. Eight wins later, she's the number one ahead of Envy Park and Stacey Lewis. She's cool, calm, always composed, and there apparently is no weakness in her game. She is fun to watch, guys, and that's really all I've got to say about it. I just can't wait to see what she does over the next 2, 3, 4 years. You know, she's going to blow the Nancy Lopez, Annika Sörenstrand, Lorena Ochoa records out of the books. And really, I think, unless barring injury or some other unforeseen thing, really dominate the game over the next several years.
Yeah, Fred, I've got to agree with that. I think, you know, I agree with what Mike pointed out about the Canadian Open a number of years ago, which she won, of course, back-to-back on different golf courses, indeed, at that age. I think that, I've said this before on the show, I think that's one of the greatest achievements in the history of the game. I really do. I reckon that up there with Frances Wee-Mitt winning the U.S. Open back in 1913. But more than that as well, you know, she's carried it on and she's progressed as a player, and to be the number one player in the world and to be winning the major championship she did at the Evian at this age is astonishing. And we've seen young players emerge on the LPGA Tour in the past, of course. But I don't think any of them have ever looked as assured as she does, both as a golfer, but also as a person. Psychologically, she's very bright. Of course, she wants to maybe perhaps study psychology when she gets a bit older. She's a very intelligent young lady, and we see her, the way she manages herself in the golf course, all remains at that even keel in terms of her emotions, but also the way she plots her way around. She's a great strategist in the course. Her maturity beguiles her years, and she also has the technical skills to back it up, and that's, of course, the most important thing. It's all fine having the brain, but you have the skills to do it, then she has both of these things, and that's why she is so good, and she's so consistent. There's no real obvious weakness to her game. She's good at everything, and that's why she's able to have such great consistency and be at the top of the game most weeks. And you know, it is a thrill to watch her play, a thrill to see her being interviewed, and I do agree with Mike. I think it's not just the most under-reported story in golf, I think it's the most under-reported story in sport as a whole. You have someone of that age who is arguably the best player in the game, who's winning majors, being number one in the world, you know, with that incredible, you know, not missing a cut for so long as she did. It's remarkable. And if she was in any other sport, or if indeed, as Mike said, unfortunately, if she was a man, then we would be, it would be stratospheric, and it would be all over all sports pages and newspapers and all over all sports channels and TV. But Lydia Ko deserves that recognition because you know, she's incredible. But at the same time, I think she's probably quite comfortable with that lack of recognition. She's able to go about and enjoy her life the way she wants to and be the well-rounded young lady that she actually is, as well as being a great golfer. And we certainly look forward to following her progress in the coming years, because she certainly has the potential to get up there with the records that Annika set and so on, and winning so many majors and really dominating the game for a number of years to come. And you know, she's great experience behind her already, and you know, she's going to be one of the great stories to follow in 2016, undoubtedly.
Also, I think that because of her calm and cool and collected demeanor, maybe she doesn't attract that much attention from the world of sports. But anyway, I wouldn't be...
Well, you know what, Carlos, you know what? Lydia Ko, then, needs to be more like Donald Trump to get in the newspapers.
She and Donald could call her up and give her some lessons.
Indeed.
I was just going to compare it, you know, to the Ronda Rousey story. That she's all this brash and she got all this attention. But, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if she makes it to number one in our stories next year. But anyway, let's move on as we are closing now soon into our show. To number two, last year, our number five story was Tiger Woods. He made it because he had a back injury in August, and he's a back injury. And first surgery on it, he struggled mightily and made a swing coach change to Chris Como. This year he makes it at number two under apparently similar circumstances. But Kieran, tell us why. It might look similar, but it's eerily different this time.
Yes, Carl, I think that's really important to point out. You know, that there's almost a sense of finality with Tiger at the moment in terms of his career as a player. You know, last year and in the past as well, previous injury problems, he's rebounded from to some extent. But to have the same problem reoccur again, as it did, of course, this year, with a further micro-dissectomy surgery on his back, it almost feels like we are entering not just the post-Tiger era, but more a case of Tiger may never play again. And that is a horrifying thought when you consider he was ranked number one in the world only 2 years ago, the end of 2013, having won five times that year. And I'll cut my remarks slightly shorter for this segment because obviously I'm pressed for time. But, you know, it has been a sorry tale to follow Tiger in the past couple of years. You know, after dominating the game and unquestionably exhilarating us as golf fans for more than a decade with his 14 major championships and dozens of titles all across the world, you know, injuries, swing changes, of course, the mental ramifications, psychological effects after the scandal erupted in 2009 and the great humiliation that came from that, you know, that must have had an effect on him psychologically as well. And it has led to this sort of soon-to-be 40-year-old, as he will be at the end of this month. You know, he's become a shell of his former self on the course, and it's sad to watch. You get kids now, and I remember last year I was on the golf course, and I ended up playing with two young 12-year-old boys. You know, I caught them, and I played with them for a few holes, and they were great players, but they almost didn't even know who Tiger Woods was. They were all big Rory fans. They loved Rory. Tiger was an afterthought. If you think about it, when Tiger last won his major in 2008, those kids were only 4 or 5 years old, and that's the difference now. This Tiger is almost a generation beyond what we have now. The game has progressed so abruptly in the past few years that Tiger has become not an afterthought, but on the course he's become almost a forgotten man, a shadow. And you know, it has been sad to watch this year in particular. We saw the round of 82 in Phoenix back in February in one of the easiest courses in the PGA Tour, where he was seemingly battling, chipping, yet so he turned out to be some sort of technical problem, but it was horrific to watch him knife chip through the green and just looking completely uncomfortable. Given we remember the great shot he played in 2005 in the 16th at the Masters, that chip in, one of those extraordinary shots you've ever seen under pressure. You know, that Tiger is long gone. And of course, he had the withdrawal from the Farmers Insurance, Torrey Pines, where he had great success due to injury. He did show resilience, of course, by finishing credibly 17th at the Masters, I think through sheer will and determination he did that. But of course, he finished near the bottom of the field at the US Open at Chambers Bay. And even the most optimistic Tiger fans going into the Open at St Andrews, of course, where he's had great success before and it's his favourite golf course in the world, it was sad to watch that. You know, he stood in that first tee on Thursday with an iron off the first tee of the old course and he duffed it off the tee. It must have went less than 200 yards. And then he hit his second shot into the burn, the smoking burn. And he missed the cut by a mile and on a golf course that he had dominated previously. And that's how far Tiger had fallen. Of course, he then missed the PGA, cut the PGA Championship as well. He did bounce back with a solid performance at the Greensboro tournament, which Davis Love won. But in the end, Tiger won, finished 10th, and that was fantastic for him. But we were celebrating that when in reality, a 51-year-old man who had no success in the tour for a number of years won that tournament. That's how low Tiger had become. And after a slight bit of progress, another injury, more back trouble, more surgery. And Tiger has no timeline to come back. He has no timetable. His recovery has been incredibly slow. He hasn't been able to do anything. He's barely been able to play with his kids, which is a massive thing for him. And, of course, he spoke recently to Lauren Rubenstein, who's a great golf writer, in Time magazine. Gave a really rare, in-depth, sit-down interview, which you probably haven't really seen for well over a decade from Tiger. And it was among the most open, perhaps the most open interview he's ever given in his career. And it was a fascinating read, and he spoke about the injuries, his career to this point, obviously turning 40, the milestone that will bring, and you know, he also commented on the injuries and relationships, of course, of his ex-wife Elin and Lindsay Vonn, the skier, and how important his children are to him, and now golf isn't the main thing for him anymore. You know, it once was, now it isn't. The kids are now his priority, and he made the point that, you know, Tiger's had 7 surgeries now in his knees and his back and his Achilles and so on, and he does not want to go through another one. And if he cannot come back to golf without risking another surgery, then he won't do it, because he does not want to risk his long-term health. He wants to have an active relationship with his children when they get into sports and they play different things. He wants to be able to enjoy that with them. And he was almost in that interview opening up an exit strategy from the game as a player. If he can come back, if he can be 100% fit and he can go out there and he can play to almost pain-free without any real serious repercussions, and I think he'll try and do that. But if he cannot, then he won't. And you know what? He's perfectly right to do that. He's got his priorities correct, and you know, we'll have to credit him for that. But it is sad. You know, he was We don't think back to the turn of the century and what he did there, winning the four majors in a row. I think arguably that was even greater than the single season Grand Slam. Simple reason that, you know, you get a period of maybe a hot streak of maybe 2 or 3 months, you can win three majors in the summer. US Open, Open, PGA. Tiger did that, but then he came back 8 months later and won the Masters in 2001. And I think that it was arguably even greater than what a season Grand Slam would be, apart from the historical significance, of course. But what Tiger did was incredible. You know, to win in the US Open by 15 shots, that's the best golf anyone's ever played. I'm sorry, young Tom Morris in 1872, but I think Tiger was better than you. And, you know, it's a sad state, but the legacy for Tiger now is Jason Day, is Rory McIlroy, is Jordan Spieth. They are his legacy. These guys are in the game largely because of his influence. He made the game cool again back in the 90s. You know, he was the figurehead. He transcended all races and whatever else and class, and he just attracted everybody, all kinds of people to the game that never would have been otherwise. And I think it's time, you know, whether Tiger comes back, we hope he comes back and he has great moments in the future. I think it's now extremely unlikely. I would bet against him. I can't see him coming back at any level at all. I hope I'm wrong, but I think it's now got the stage where he's so far behind, not just physically, but he's so far behind technically now the best players in the game that it's hard to see a window for him to come back into the sport. And that's sad to say, but I think at this moment, you know, he's had a fantastic career. He'll have a great legacy going forward, and he's heavily involved charitably, of course, with his foundation, and he'll be involved in the game going forward, a game that he loves so much, of course. But his legacy and his achievements, we should celebrate that as being arguably the greatest that we've ever seen. And, you know, what a player. We had the pleasure of being around to watch Tiger. I was a youngster growing up watching Tiger. You know, it was incredible to watch. And he transcended sports, ages, nationalities. He was incredible. And there never will be another Tiger. That's to be that clear. But the players who are coming up now behind him, Spieth, Rory, Day, they're there because of Tiger, and that is ultimately his greatest legacy. And, you know, what he's done for golf throughout the years, we've got to celebrate. And if he is to come back, hope it is, when he's fit and healthy, and he comes back as a competitive player, but I think it's unfortunately. But, and Mike, you know, Tiger achieved incredible things. It's been sad to watch him in the past couple of years, has dramatically declined. But what a career it's been for Tiger. And if it is the end for him, then we have a lot to celebrate.
Well, you know, the game of golf is a lifetime game. You don't necessarily have to play it. You can remain involved for well past your competitive days, and I think Tiger will remain that, will remain as involved as he possibly can be. I saw the interview on NBC during his event in the Bahamas, and he admitted he is at a standstill right now because of his health. That is the focal point of his life, as well as staying involved with his children's lives. And he can't even predict when he can start practicing because his back has not got to the point to allow him to even begin to speculate on when he might be able to start training so he can begin to think about a comeback. So he is totally at a standstill, and there's another story here that many people don't think about, and that's, first of all, the golf swing is an unnatural movement, and that's why a lot of people have injuries, because to do the golf swing time and time and time again is not the easiest on your body, especially your back. But the thing with Tiger, he's been playing golf since he was knee-high to a grasshopper, been trained to be a golfer. He's been swinging that club just day after day, year after year. And the injuries that we're seeing with Tiger, we're also seeing with other young athletes in other sports who are just getting so focused too early, too young of age, whether it's soccer, basketball, baseball, lacrosse, etc. And when you do get focused, like Tiger was and has been for a long time, you can experience success. The downside is your career may come to a premature end because the body just can't do it as much as you want it to. And that's one reason why Jordan Spieth, actually, who played junior football in Texas and was a pitcher and played these other sports, he actually may be physically in a situation to go longer than someone like Tiger because he was not golf specific until probably his late high school into his college years. So we'll see how that pans out in the coming years. But it's sad to see Tiger still at the young age of 39 at a point that he can't even pitch and putt. In fact, he said that his life is pretty much revolving around watching television and playing video games. And the game has flourished under Tiger and will continue to do well because of Tiger. I concur with Kieran's thoughts about the legacy of Tiger as in Day and Spieth and McIlroy and these kind of players who he inspired. And so the legacy of Tiger will carry on for years, and gosh, I hope he can come back and be competitive. That would be fun for a 42-year-old Tiger Woods to go dueling down the back nine against Spieth and McIlroy and, of course, my good friend Koepka. So we'll see. I wish him the best of luck, but he realizes that his destiny is not in his hands. It's in his body's ability to get well, and I think he wants to get well so that he can maybe play soccer with his kids and play basketball with his kids and then think about playing golf.
Well, guys, I'm just happy I got to watch him, really going back to his youth, watching him win three junior U.S. amateurs, three U.S. amateurs in six consecutive years, 14 majors. He said the other day, everything after this is gravy. So he's kind of resigned himself to the fact that this might be it, and it may very well be. He's had a tremendous career. Maybe not going to get to 18 majors, not going to catch Jack, but nonetheless, it's been fun to watch. Carlos?
Definitely. And finally, last year I had the number 12 story of the year on our show, and I had to listen back to that show and transcribe my ending to it, and I'm going to say it. Spieth is now number 9 in the world. Doesn't turn 22 until the summer. A taste of things to come. Fred, just remember that last year it was an Australian Open win that sparked a run that might have captured some headlines. They won by a guy with the name of Rory McIlroy. Fred, this year he won all the accolades and made the biggest leap, 11 slots in our stories, the number one story of the year. How about Jordan Spieth?
Yeah, Carlos, you took my lead sentence. Jordan Spieth's year really began in Australia in 2014. He won the Australian Open by 6 shots and posted a final round 63 on Sunday when very few players could break 70. He put on a clinic. He flew directly to Orlando, Florida for the Hero World Challenge at Isleworth, and his out-of-body experience continued with a 10-stroke win. His third round 63 again blew away the field. A pair of 63s on two very good golf courses on opposite sides of the world in 1 week's time set the golf world on fire. It is very good to be young and talented. When the calendar turned over to 2015, he took January off, but picked right up in February to dominate leaderboards. He captured 7 top 10 finishes in his first 9 starts of the year. For 4 weeks in March and April, he won the Valspar for the second time in 3 years, was runner-up at both the Valero Texas Open and the Shell Houston Open, and then won the next week at the Masters for his first major. After missing the cut to Players in May, he rolled off another impressive run of 7 top 10s in his next 8 starts. This included his win at the U.S. Open on a nearly unplayable Chambers Bay parking lot, a second win at the John Deere the week prior to the Open Championship at St. Andrews, where he finished out of the playoff by 1 shot and finished 4th. He also had 2 runners-up and a 3rd during that stretch. But he was just getting warmed up at a T10 at the WGC Bridgestone at Firestone, by the way, Kieran, just a little track up the road here, and another runner-up at the PGA Championship, where he battled Jason Day. Gave him 2 wins, a 4th alibi, it was 1 shot back at the Open, really kind of runner-up, and a runner-up at the PGA. Not a bad year in the majors. By winning the first 2 majors of the year, the Masters U.S. Open, he captured the mind of every golf fan in the world. Jack Nicklaus and Tiger Woods had stalked the elusive Grand Slam for their entire careers, and although Woods has the Tiger Slam, neither was able to win all 4 in a single year. Spieth appeared to be the guy to get it done. There didn't seem to be a fairway he couldn't split, a green he couldn't find, or a putt he didn't like. He made putts from everywhere. He honestly had a chance to win the Grand Slam. A bad lie on the road hole on Sunday and mud on the ball for his second shot at the 18th at St. Andrews may have been the difference and prevented him from getting one more birdie to make the playoff. It may have been a moot point, however, because Jason Day played out of his mind, as was not to be denied, at Whistling Straits. Spieth never seems to be bothered by his near misses. He accepted his defeat with a smile, tip of the cat, and a hearty handshake.
$12 million, $22 million for the year. Carlos, I know I got to wrap this up. He's only 22 years old. Can't wait till next year.
Guys, we have a little time, so quick responses from both of you.
Well, Carlos, I'll quickly say this on Spieth there. I know Spieth made the impossible, the improbable seem possible at St Andrews when he held that long putt in the 16th there to get tie the lead at the Old Course. He almost made the Grand Slam a possibility, and that was an astonishing thing to achieve, particularly at that age, of course. And, you know, for me, you know, Spieth, he was ultimately four shots away from completing the Grand Slam in a single season. That it will go down in history as one of the truly great seasons in the game, and I look forward to seeing if he can carry it on next year and the years to come. He has a long career ahead of him, and he's got a hell of a platform there to build potentially one of the great careers in the history of the game.
Mike?
Well, Jordan Spieth, he was just nothing short of spectacular this year. He made every putt when he needed to make a putt. When he missed a shot, he missed it at the right spot. And he always looked fit. He looked focused. And it looked like he was having a lot of fun. And when you put those three things together, you get good results. I think his success at the Masters this year was based on his runner-up performance to Bubba Watson in 2014. I think he came in prepared to take it to another level, and he did. And again, what he did at U.S. Open, he put all the adversity and all the controversy and about the humps and the bumps and the uneasiness that the players had and the inconsistency of the green and in the cream. In the end, the cream rose to the top. And he said, if that's what we all have to play, then I'll do the very best I can. And his best was better than anyone else, despite the fact he had that untimely double bogey on the 71st hole out there at Chambers Bay. He still came back, and again, it was. And then what he did, gosh, almost winning the. You know, he made that great putt on 15 at the British Open, to 16 to put him right there, and then came in second at the PGA Championship. Again, his best days are in front of him, and as much as I say when Rory's on all cylinders, he's the best. Gosh, he may only be a half a stroke better than Jordan Spieth, and maybe we're underselling Jordan Spieth. Maybe he's truly going to be better than Tiger and better than Rory and better than Jack. Time will tell. I think the great thing about Jordan is his younger sister has some mental disability issues, and I think that keeps him humbled. He always thinks about her, always talks about her, and he's just a regular guy. He comes from a solid family, and what is there not to like about Jordan Spieth? He's all-American, he's clean-cut, he's well-spoken, good-looking guy, talented, fantastic. We're lucky to have him in golf. Whatever sport he would have chosen to do, he probably would have done well. And he's a great ambassador for sports, a tremendous ambassador for golf. And I'm just pleased that he's an American because he represents the game in a way that it should be represented. And I'm sure people like Jack Nicklaus and Arnold Palmer and Tom Watson are delighted to see that someone like Jordan Spieth is now representing the game in the way they did. And I think Ben Crenshaw is also saying, I told you so, because he predicted the success years ago. And I do remember when Jordan Spieth, as a 16-year-old, was competing in the final round of the Byron Nelson and was in the top 10 and tried to win. And you're thinking, how can a 16-year-old do so well at a PGA Tour event, let alone almost win the thing? And he went to Texas, stayed a year there, and just jumped to the PGA Tour and, again, it's just taking it from one level to the next. And, gosh, what's going to happen in 2016? Will it be three majors? Will he win a Grand Slam, or will the competition get stronger and make him earn every penny that he gets next year? So, it's we're going to have an exciting year in 2016. It's just a few days away, and I'm sure all these players are spending the offseason resting, preparing, getting ready. And, again, the one guy we've already talked about is Ricky Fowler, and what he did at the Players' Championship pulling down the stretch, that was nothing short of amazing. It was Spieth-like. So we'll see what happens next year. It's depends on a lot of outside factors. And gosh, wouldn't it be neat if Tiger Woods could get healthy and be on the Ryder Cup team? So we'll see.
Well, guys, we run out of time, so a busy year in golf means that some compelling stories don't make the cut. We're positive that you enjoyed our picks. Certainly 2015 was one of the best years in golf, and we look forward to what the encore until 2016 brings. Back Niners, that wraps up one other season, one more year of the Back Nine Report by eDraft.com. It's always our pleasure to bring you the latest on the world of golf. Thank you for listening to us. Special thanks to Kieran Clark and Mike May for your participation here on the top stories of the year 2015. Don't forget to join us again next Tuesday, January 15. We're going to be off the next two Tuesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern Time here on Blog Talk Radio, and also through tune in or download our show on iTunes. If you haven't done so, follow the show. Our Twitter ID is at Back94. My name is Carlos Torres, along with Fred Alvader, Kieran Clark, and Mike May. We wish you to be happy. Happy holidays, happy new year, be blessed, and enjoy the great game of golf. Happy golfing, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Merry Christmas.